right, children, you may be dismissed for children's church. While they're being dismissed, I'll let you find your place in Mark chapter 6. I will have some information handed out to you. It's not a fill in the blank. This is actually background information to the message this morning. And so the ushers are coming with some of that. When you find your place in Mark chapter 6, stick your finger or your kid or something there and mark your spot, and then turn to Matthew chapter 10. And what we are going to accomplish this morning, Lord willing, will be a synoptic or a simultaneous study of Mark chapter 6 and Matthew chapter 10. The reason I want to do this is this is somewhat of a tangent message. And what I mean by that is I was thinking about Father's Day. And I was thinking about the topic of fatherhood. But I didn't think a message entitled The Fatherhood of God would go over too well here, being that that's a Unitarian type idea. And though through studying the way that our Abba Father treats us, don't get stressed out about that handout. I'll explain it in just a minute. I know it looks like a football play. But the way our Abba Father treats us is a tremendous example to us as fathers and how to treat our children. That being said, I got to thinking about God. I got to thinking about Jesus Christ. And then I coupled those thoughts with some of the information that I've been reading in the paper over the past several weeks. I have here an article, and this is the title of the article. And this article is actually promoting a ministry, and I think it's a good social service ministry. But here's the title, 30 teen moms to graduate high school. 18-year-old Maisha Weber, and you know, it goes on to tell her story about her 7-month-old daughter. She graduated from Crest High School a few weeks ago, becoming a mother while still enrolled in high school. 30 young women honored Friday in the 8th annual CIS Teen Parent Graduation Celebration. This year's graduating class was the largest ever. Okay, that sounds like a good thing for the program, but it's not. It means that many more, maybe that many more are actually graduating now. But you've got 30 teen moms in one class that are graduating. That's just the graduates. It's not counting all the ones that dropped out before graduation. Teen Parents as Teachers Dropout Prevention Program helps teen mothers in Cleveland County with routine home visits, health screening for babies, and group activities. They basically teach these ladies how to be moms while finishing their education. Now, here's another from June the 12th, just a few days ago, titled Terminating Parents' Rights. When does DSS step in and take over the parents' rights? So far this year, get this is Cleveland County, this is your neighborhood. So far this year, 11 children have been taken from the parents and taken into custody to the Cleveland County Department of Social Services, and the parents' rights terminated. This isn't government takeover. These are people that they are working with in order to try to help the kids stay in the home, but the number one reason is not abuse. The number one reason is incompetence. That's why children are being taken away, because they're not getting diapers changed. They're not being fed. They're not being put to bed. They're asked to live in horrible living conditions. Last year, 38 parents lost the right to raise their children. In April alone, 16 children were taken into custody, for a total of 224 taken into custody this year. It's June, folks. These are April and May's numbers. Okay, what am I saying? I'm saying that there are parents that they take the children out of the home and then try to reintegrate them into the home without terminating the parents' right completely. This year alone, 224 kids in Cleveland County. Here's your 2010, 2011, 2012. 2010, 21 terminations of the right to parent. 2011, 38. 2012, 11 so far this year. Children taken into custody, 224. 122 of those are temporarily in foster homes. What am I saying? I'm saying we got some dads that aren't doing their jobs. I'm saying we have a tremendous example in our community of children who are being asked to live in horrible situations. We have men who are shirking their responsibility. Many of the men that I have read the criminal reports over the past few weeks are fathers. They're now in jail. What am I saying? I'm saying there's an obvious need in our community for fathers. That being said, I realize I'm not preaching to the jail ministry this morning. I realize we have men who want to serve the Lord, who want to do what's right. Men who are trying to lead their homes properly. Yet I think our topic this morning is the key element between the two extremes. I agree that there are many men who want to be a good father. I agree that there are many men who are not good fathers. They are terrible fathers. They're worse than infidels. They are not providing for their family. They're not providing emotionally, mentally, spiritually. They're not providing for their family. So what's that one area? What's the one area where we all seem to struggle? I think if you were to boil down every man's challenges, no matter what his profession, I think it would come down to this topic. Going the extra mile. Daddy comes home from work. He's tired. He's frustrated. Maybe he's carrying burdens. Maybe there's pressures, some fair, some unfair, on him. And then he still has a family to be responsible for. Maybe he's met with another day that was just as bad in the home as it was for him in the office. Maybe he's struggling to make ends meet. You know, the number of people who are working two jobs in our society has increased over the past 10 years, almost double. But that is a consistent struggle for every man. But I think it's something that every one of us struggle with. What is a true biblical mile? Well, we're in Matthew 10, but let me just reference Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, if you are compelled to go with someone a mile, I'm paraphrasing, go with him twain, or go with him 2 miles. You see, under the Roman impressment law, which was Roman martial law, if a Roman soldier passed you, he could say, you have to carry my pack for up to a mile. By law, you were forced to go with him. That's part of being in a Roman protected society. However, he couldn't force you to go any further. Now, Jesus was teaching that there is a certain expectation placed on all of us. But when it comes to our service to other people, he doesn't want Christians to be average, law-abiding citizens. That's basic. He wants us to be much more than that. So what is this extra mile living? We obviously are not under Roman martial law, and Jesus was in no way limiting his teaching to carrying somebody's pack for them. Let's look at the passage before us and look by the context, look how Jesus went the extra mile. You know, one thing I have learned is that whether it's parenting or whether it is preaching, most of the time, whatever you preach really doesn't take solid root in someone else's life unless you or somebody else shows them how to do it. I can tell Jack to go clean his room, but that's left up to a broad interpretation, okay? But if I show him what clean is, then he has something that he can work with, okay? If we say we need to go the extra mile, that can be left to our interpretation of what the extra mile is. So Jesus, in his mercy, demonstrated it for us this morning. Look, please, at the handout you have. I ran two timelines. The arrow are the way the timeline happened. And this is kind of like I go home on Sunday nights, I plan out my week, and I come in Monday morning to this facility, and I start working on the projects that I'm supposed to take care of. Brother West does something different. Brother Matt is over at the college, and Brother Joe sits with his feet. He comes and works at the church here too. And you all go to different places, and we do different stuff, okay? We all live the same week. But we all live different aspects of the same week. And here in Matthew and Mark, you have details that really help draw things together And many times we overlook just how important that context is. So if you would, just stick with me for a few moments, because the context that I'm going to give you right now is the crux of my message, okay? So stick with me. I'll give you a nod when you can fall asleep, and then you'll still have the message. But for right now, I need you to stick with me. In Mark chapter 5, verse number 40, Jesus was laughed to scorn for saying that the daughter of the ruler of the synagogue wasn't dead, she was sleeping. Of course, we know from the next couple verses leading into chapter 6 that the scoffers missed out on seeing this miracle that Jesus performed when he raised the girl from the dead. But the fact remains, Jesus had to put up with that. Okay? Then in chapter 6, Mark explains that Jesus went from the ruler's house back to his own country, where the wisdom of his Sabbath day teachings and even the miracles that he performed were not enough to persuade his own countrymen that he was the Messiah. That can be difficult, trying to live and operate and be an effective minister in your own community. That's why we start within our own community, because if we can master that, we can master going to the uttermost parts of the world. Now notice with me, Matthew chapter 14 and verse number 1. Matthew chapter 14 and verse number 1. We'll read through Matthew 14 and Mark chapter 6, flipping back and forth. It says, "At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard of the fame of Jesus, and he, Herod, said unto his servants, This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works do show forth themselves in him." I want you to understand that Matthew is making a summary statement. Okay, he is making a thesis statement, and then the rest of the chapter explains the story. Okay, from a timeline perspective, chronologically, you can see on your sheet that Herod actually heard of the fame of Jesus after the feeding of the 5,000. That's all the way at the bottom. Okay, just trying to lay things out chronologically so we can see what's going on in Jesus' life. Okay, these verses are a summary. So then, you have two simultaneous timelines developing. On the one hand, you have Jesus being bombarded with scoffing, dishonor, unbelief, the limiting of his miraculous power. You have all of these things going on in Jesus' life. On the other hand, you have Herod the pervert, who takes his brother Philip's wife and claims her for his own. And then John the Baptist, the preacher, comes in and says, "You're wrong for doing it and for committing adultery," and Herod throws him into prison. It was also during this time, the verse we just read about Jesus in his own country, he's being scoffed and made fun of. Look at Mark chapter 6, verse number 7. Now stick with me here. "And Jesus, he called unto them the 12, and began to send them forth by two and two, and gave them power over unclean spirits, and commanded them that they should not, that they should take nothing for their journey, save only a staff, no scrip, no bread, no money in their purse, but he be shod with sandals, and not put on two coats." Okay? That's your next event. He sends out the 12. Now, at the same time, back in Matthew 14, verse number 3, Herod had laid hold on John and bound him and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. Matthew 14, verse 4. "For John said unto him, It's not lawful for thee to have her. And when he would put him to death, he feared the multitude, because he counted him as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday was kept, then Herodias danced before him." Okay, so this is the timeline. We're working through this, all right? Are you still with me? Meanwhile, the wicked Queen Herodias has been scheming a plan to kill John the Baptist. You see that Jesus has sent his disciples away. John has a brief lapse of faith when all this is going on. We don't know how long he was in prison, but at some point during his imprisonment, John sent to Jesus and said, "Hey, are you really even the Messiah?" And Jesus sends back communication to John. So I don't know if that is before or after, or how that fits in the timeline as far as the 12 being sent out. But at some point, there is a communication between John the Baptist and Jesus, and that's the last known communication between the two on this earth. So at Herod's birthday party, let's look at Matthew 14, verse 6. "The daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod, whereupon he promised with an oath to give her whatsoever she would ask. And she, being before instructed of her mother, said, Give me here John the Baptist's head in a charger or a platter. And the king was sorry, nevertheless, for the oath's sake, and them that sat with him at meat, he commanded it to be given her." in Mark it said he summoned the executioner, and the executioner beheaded John the Baptist. That's how John the Baptist died. You have a man who was easily controlled by his passions. You have a woman who took advantage of that, and John the Baptist was murdered. By the way, this is a great verse for proving that sorriness does nothing towards salvation or sanctification. Herod was sorry about what he had to do, but it didn't change anything that he did. There's a lot of people that feel bad about the way they're living, and they won't do anything about it. But anyway, it's very similar in my mind to having a rifle with no firing pin. You can pull the trigger over and over and over again, and nothing's going to happen. It won't fire. You do know what you call a rifle without a firing pin, don't you? A club. Okay, that's the only one that thought that was funny. Anyway, back to verse number 10. And he, Herod, sent and beheaded John in prison, and his head was brought in a charger or a platter and given to the damsel, and she brought it to her mother. And John's disciples came and took up the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. Now, while John the Baptist's disciples were on their way to tell Jesus about this horrible thing that had just happened to John the Baptist, Mark chapter 6, verse 30 and 31, flip over there. This is the next thing that happened. The apostles gathered themselves unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. Verse 31, and he said unto them, come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. Then John the Baptist's disciples show up with the tragic news of John's death, and now we're kind of in real time, okay? So this is the setting in which the feeding of the 5,000 takes place. Let me just highlight a couple of them. You have people that are limiting and frustrating Jesus' ministry. You have Jesus having people doubt him, and he's trying to minister to others who in the waning moments of their life are struggling with doubt. He sends away all of his earthly fellowship, and then he gets those folks back, and they're just bombarding him with information, telling him everything that they've done. They're excited, and then boom, he gets tragic news about his forerunner, his family member, his friend, John the Baptist. Okay? That's the context. Now, let's pick up in Matthew chapter 14, verse number 13. When Jesus heard of John the Baptist's beheading, he and his disciples, according to Mark chapter 6, departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. I want you to understand that the first reaction in the extra mile, in going the extra mile, the first way Jesus demonstrates that he went the extra mile is by demonstrating, number one, that there is a time to retreat. Now you say, how in the world could you go the extra mile by retreating? Well, by understanding this, the extra mile is not an accomplishment. It's not some badge of honor. Oh, you went the extra mile. Ding, I get a badge for it. That's not how it works. The extra mile living is a philosophy of life that you must choose to embrace even under pressure. And one of the smartest things you can do when you're getting into something that's way over your head is to just take some time apart. Just go be with the Lord. Don't run to your friends. Don't run to your favorite counselors. Don't run straight to the pastor's office. It's always open. Understand that. But spend some time with the Lord. Let God teach you some things that nobody else can. It says he departed. That word means to go back, to return, to withdraw from battle. That's the idea of that word return. When Jesus returned, he withdrew himself. Understand that every Christian will be exposed to these kind of situations. Jesus faced hard problems. No Christian is exempt from the opportunity to go the extra mile. But so often we either think, ha-ha, this is an opportunity for me to be super awesome Christian man, or we think, oh, great, here we go again. And so often we don't go the extra mile because we either don't do it properly or we limit what God can do because of our decisions to choose not to go the extra mile. What was Jesus' response to the devastating news of his friend? He withdrew. He departed. He exited. The first response to every devastating situation should always be immediate withdrawal for private prayer. But notice when Jesus tried to make his exit, verse 13. And when the people, the last half of verse 13, and when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. They were following after Jesus. He was pursued. Jesus tried to get away, but he was pursued. So what happened when Jesus got off the ship and saw this great multitude of people? Well, he showed us, number two, not only a time to retreat, but there is a time to receive, or a time to relieve. What do I mean by that? We must remember that although Jesus may or may not have had a brief opportunity of prayer, he's crossing in this ship. When Jesus got into the ship to go to the other side, he still got his disciples. And it was absolute chaos when these 12 came back. You know, you got to think, these guys were Jews, big Jewish family. You got everybody coming in. They didn't even have time to eat, okay? So now they hop in a boat, and more than likely, Jesus was still listening to their stories, or he was listening to them vent their sadness about John the Baptist. You know, that's one thing about leadership. You're usually the last one, the first one that gets called and the last one to get the opportunity to hurt. You got to be there for other people, and you've got to work through it. And that's part of working with people. And you know, the more people that you minister to, the more God expands your ministry, the more you're going to have to be there for other people before you get your time to hurt, before you get your time to retreat. Now, Jesus still hadn't had any opportunity for alone time. He gets off the ship, and even with a heavy heart, an exhausted and hungry staff, if you will, remember the whole reason they left was so they could rest and eat, okay? So now he's got a tired, maybe grumpy staff. They get off the ship, verse 14, he says, he saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. You remember a few weeks ago when I preached on radical love, and I said the only way that we're going to be effective is if we see a need, feel a need, and give to that need. We give time, talent, or resources to that need. If you don't do all three, you won't be affected. You can see needs. Great. You've got good vision. Okay? You can feel bad for a need. Great. You feel bad for it. But until that compassion moves you to action, you will never be effective in people's lives. If you can't see it, you can't help them. If you don't see needs, then you've got a problem reaching out to people. If you don't allow it to affect your heart, mine eye hath affected my heart. If you don't allow it to affect your heart, and through that affecting of your heart, move yourself to action in one way or another, whatever God has blessed you with, if he's blessed you with the resources, if he blessed you with the time, or if he's blessed you with the talent, move to action, you will not make an impact on people's lives. That's why many times we're ineffective. But that's exactly what Jesus did here. It says he saw a great multitude. He was moved with compassion. He entered into it emotionally. And I'm not an emotional, crazy person. I like to have fun, and I can be calm, and I can be crazy. I like to do both. But understand, there's a proper place for emotion in ministry. There's a time when some people have come up to me and not said a word when I was going through something tough, and just... you could see that if they said anything, they were going to cry. They just nodded their head, gave me a fern head shake, and walked off. That meant a lot to me because of the way it was done. And we don't use emotions to manipulate people. But let's not be so robotic or exhausted or worn out that we don't allow our emotions to be effective. Even tired, even sad in his own heart, Jesus took the time to be emotionally involved with other people. He saw the needs. He was moved with compassion. And he gave of himself to heal their sick. Verse 14, when it says Jesus went forth, this is as an actor that comes on stage. In other words, he was in full view. And one thing that's true is when you're hurting, you don't like to be in the front of everything. You don't like it. It's not fun. Okay? But Jesus was willing to expose himself in the middle of his difficult hour. Not only was Jesus seen, but he also saw. He saw a great multitude. That saw, it carries the idea of perception. When you see people, do you see people? I mean, do you really see people? When you walk past people, do you see blurry objects that have clothes on? Or do you see a person? You know, just because they're not saved doesn't mean they can't think. Doesn't mean they're not smart. Doesn't mean they don't love and hurt and feel the same things you and I do. What do you see when you walk past people? You know, sometimes our grocery list is so important that we walk right past somebody that if we would take the time to perceive that person, it would help us. It would help us understand when not to say something, and it would help us to understand, hey, this person's wide open and they need a friend. So let me extend of myself to this person. He came, he comprehended, and he had compassion. When Jesus had compassion, it was not the way that a lot of these portrayals do it. I am disgusted when I see some of these movies or videos or short whatever, and Jesus is made to look out like a hippie girl, and the smile that he has, you're like, is he attracted to me? Or, you know, they try to make him look gentle, but in doing so, they make him look weak. Understand, this compassion is not some sort of weakness. It is not some sort of femi manipulation. This compassion was two things. It was purpose. It was compassion toward the people, toward them, and it was productive. Matthew 14:14 says, he healed their sick. I would say that is active compassion. That is productive. Mark 6:34 says, he also taught them many things. He gave of himself so that he could teach them. In other words, he met their physical needs so he could meet their spiritual need. I'm not in favor of producing Rice Christians, but there are some people that can't hear anything because they're hurting so bad. When you comfort them a little bit, then they can start listening. And there are times when, whether it's emotional or physical, we need to help people so that we can give them the gospel. And again, I'm not saying that we need to come up with a soup kitchen, but I am saying that we do need to pay attention to what's going on in our neighborhoods, to what's going on at our workplace, to what's going on around us. Jesus saw these needs, and his compassion was very, very productive. How do you interact with people that have problems? Do you give of yourself? See, Jesus had his own problems, right? He had a lot on his plate. He had a lot in his capacity that he was responsible for. And yet these other people were the ones that he was ministering to. Hey, you know, sometimes you got to minister broken. Sometimes you got to finish what you started, even with a broken heart. And that's exactly what Jesus did here. Do you see a bunch of sick people, physically or spiritually? Do you see people that have problems? Or do you see, like Jesus, Mark chapter 6, sheep having no shepherd? How do you see people? How do we really see people? Do you see them like, well, you know, I'm over here with my 12 disciples, and, you know, this is... And you know what? By the way, let me just help you with something. Jesus knew why all these problems existed, okay? So let's not try to trump that. And when we look at problems, well, if they had a budgeted better, they wouldn't be in this financial problem. Or, you know, obviously there's sin in their life because, okay, let's not be Job's friends here. We got to be careful trying to figure out why stuff. We need to do less why is this the way it is and more what do we need to do about it. I'm not saying you can eliminate the why, but don't be so consumed with trying to figure out why a person is a certain way that you eliminate the ability to just simply minister to them. Jesus said, you know what? There's sheep having no shepherd. He knew their problems. He knew exactly what sins were there. And it never says that so-and-so deserved to be healed. But he did it anyway. You know what? I don't deserve anything that I've ever been given. But somebody gave it to me. And that's part of the reason I'm in the ministry, is because somebody gave to me. Somebody helped me. Somebody had compassion on me. And that's exactly why we're all where we are. Who are we to stop that process and not have compassion on someone else? Do you look for opportunities to gently teach them? You know, hey, if I've got to use something to teach somebody, great. Use whatever you got. You got a talent. Use it for the Lord to teach somebody some biblical truths. Use whatever you have, whatever God's given you. Well, I don't have money. Fine, don't use money. Use time. Well, I don't have time. Fine, use a talent. Do something for someone that will give you the opportunity to share the gospel with them. See them as a sheep that has no shepherd. See them as somebody that needs to be led. Do you look for opportunities to gently teach people? Do you pray, God, help me help those people? Help me help my children. Help me help my staff. Help me help my employees. Help me help my pastor. Or do you use the pressures that are in your own life as an excuse to criticize and tear down other people instead of helping them? Compassion or criticism, which one are you going to choose? Back to Matthew 14, verse number 15, we see the third lesson that Jesus demonstrates regarding the extra mile. There is a time to redirect. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him saying, "This is a desert place, and there's time. The time has passed. Send the multitude away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." You see what happened here? The disciples were very, very logical. And it's a good thing to be a thinker. I encourage that, you know, with my teenagers. I encourage them to, you know, think. And I'm sure that your parents appreciate the second voice in their ear saying, think. And, you know, sometimes it's a really good thing to think, all right? But there are times when we miss the overall teaching of Scripture because we're so logical, okay? Not everything runs on the mathematical numbers. They said, look, the location is a desert place. We've been here a long time. It's getting late. Send the people away. And then they said, hey, I got a proposal for you. Let's let the people go so they can go buy victuals. In other words, let the people go fend for themselves. It's okay. You know what? Really, that's not a lot to ask of somebody to provide their own food. You know, like these people are older people. A lot of them were men besides women and children. Like, it was a normal requirement to expect them to, hey, go get some food. You know, like, you're a big boy, go get some food. But Jesus said unto them, they need not depart. He redirected their thinking and said, give ye them to eat. Now, that may seem like a simple statement, but do you see the pressure that's behind that statement? How many fish and loaves have you? You know, we have five loaves and two fishes, or two loaves. And he said, give ye them to eat. And they're like, 5,000 men plus women and children, you know, 7,500 people. That's a lot of people. You ever feel that way? You ever feel like God is putting pressure on you to do something that is absolutely impossible? God, I could never do that. Have you ever felt that way? I mean, seriously, think about it. Has God prompted your heart and you thought, there's no way I can accomplish that? Have you been there? There's no way I can provide for all these people. There's no way I can meet all those spiritual needs. There's no way that people are going to follow me in that. There's no way I can do what God wants me to do. Have compassion on that person. Forgive that person. I could never do that. Conquer this habit in my life. I can't do it. Serve someone who is that impossible to deal with. God, I cannot do it. You know, you're exactly right. You can't. And that's exactly why God wants us to do impossible things, so that we can see for our own selves that it's not us accomplishing those things. As a side note, I'm just going to mention this to dads. Notice when Jesus is working with the disciples here, how gently he redirects their thinking. You know, a lot of times we want to get it through our kids' head. So, boy, we just, boom, we say it with some emphasis and maybe bang a few things or, you know, raise our voice or scream at them or whatever. So they get it, right? But notice, Jesus says, hey, you know, let's not think that way. Let's think this way. And then he enters into the solution. You know, I have never tried that with my son that it didn't work. When I said, Jackson, let's do this. Hey, I'll help you do it. Okay, you know, he's willing to do whatever daddy wants him to do then. But if I'm like, Jack, go do this. Well, you know, and you get the whiny or the, you know, outright rebellion or whatever response your child may give you. But if you gently redirect and then enter into the solution, it takes a little bit of time. It takes a little bit of effort. But it'll help you in your parenting to apply that to your sons and daughters, your sons especially. Many times, understand this, many times, the only hindrance to God's power in our lives is our own opinions of ourselves. You realize that? You see, God had all the power that he needed to feed the 5,000 people. God had all the resources that he needed to feed all these people. What was standing in his way? The disciples' view of themselves. We can't do it. We can't do it. He said, go give them to eat. You know, I believe that if Jesus had said, go give them to eat, and the disciples started breaking bread, they would have been the one to perform the miracle. I truly believe that. Because God will use whatever resources we will give him. But at the same time, these disciples just could not grasp it. It didn't make sense to them. It's kind of like the story, I've said it once before, but it's the story of the elephant and the chicken walking across the rope bridge. And when they get to the other side, the chicken looks up at the elephant and said, you see how we made that bridge shake, big boy? You know, like, the chicken is telling the elephant that we made the bridge shake. And that's kind of how we view ourselves a lot of times when God does something. You know, like, well, did you see what we did there, God? And I don't mean to be irreverent, but understand that's a lot of times how we view ourselves. We view that God couldn't have done it without us. We really do. And in our honesty with ourselves, I think we'd have to admit that that's more often than not. After all, God did use me to sing that song. God used me to share the gospel with that person. Did you feel how we did this, Lord? God selected me as the leader of such and such. God used me to do this and that. You know, that kind of view of ourselves is going to limit what God can do with us. And you know, sometimes it's as simple as saying, God, I believe you want to accomplish this within my family, within my home, within my church. I don't know how to do it, but I know that you want it done. And if you will use me, I'll do whatever it takes to make that happen. If we came to every ministry with that mentality, with that willingness to say, it's not about me, it's about the Lord, it would revolutionize the way we serve. And it would also cause us a lot less stress on ourselves. So let me ask you, what fish and bread are you trying to serve with? What limited resources, what limited energy, what limited time, talent, money, whatever, what limited aspect are you trying to serve God? You say, God, I want to serve you and I've got this much. Instead of saying, God, you've got it all. How can I help you serve? You see, there's a completely different mentality. On the one hand, it's what I have to give, and what I have to give, when it's gone, it's gone. On the other hand, it's like, hey, God's in control of this, and I'm going to do whatever He wants me to do. And you have an unlimited resource. You have that flowing supply, as we talked about in Broken Cistern Service a few weeks ago. Hey, listen to me. You are important to me. You are important to this church. You are important to God. But let's not say that God can't do things without us, okay? I'm not saying we're unimportant. I'm saying that our opinions of ourselves are what need to change. It's not that, oh, God can't use me and I'm going to quit. No. It's just our opinions that are hindering God. I'm going to skip a few things here and skip down to number 4, verses 22 and 23. Don't be too critical of the disciples here. Jesus put them in the boat and sent them on, but a lot of times we want to say, well, if they'd have thought about this and if they'd have thought about that, you got to remember, they're coming off a missions trip. They were exhausted and they hadn't even got to eat. Well, they could have eaten on the boat. Well, first of all, it's a boat. I wouldn't recommend eating a whole lot on a little boat. Second of all, when you're coming across the sea and you just heard about one of your friends, I'm sure they didn't have a whole lot of appetite when they just heard about the brutal murder of one of their friends. Okay, so I don't think they ate. I really don't. And so they're making some of these decisions and working with the Lord and in a completely exhausted and spent state. But understand that one of the most popular miracles in the Bible, Jesus performed on a complete lack of spiritual nourishment. He had these disciples help him when they were completely spent. And it reminds me of a verse that Paul talked about, that when I am weak, then am I strong. Be careful when you pray for God to do something special with you, because He may have to make you so weak that He can accomplish that much more through you. Understand, when you pray, you may be praying for God to limit you so that you don't limit Him. All right, number 4, Jesus demonstrated that in God's timing, there is a time to recover. This time to recover is always after you have fulfilled your responsibilities. Notice verse 22, and straightway Jesus constrained His disciples to get into a ship and to go before Him unto the other side when He sent the multitudes away. And when He had sent the multitudes away, He went up into a mountain apart to pray, finally. And when the evening was come, He was there alone. What He tried to do much earlier in the day, He finally got an opportunity to do so. But when He constrained His disciples, that's the idea of compelling or forcing them into that ship. He said, hey, no, you guys go. And understand, if you're going to be the leader, if you're going to serve the way that Jesus wants you to, you got to follow through. You got to finish your task. You've got to have compassion on your people. And there comes a point where you have to expect more of yourself than you do of your people. He constrained them. And then He sent the multitudes away. This word sent has the idea of to lead forward to go before or to escort. Jesus didn't say, all right, show's over. Thanks for coming. See ya. He said, no, come on. This is the way you should go back. He was very gracious. He was very gentle. He led the people away. He was gentle with those who were under him. He was gentle with those who he sent away. But then he finally found a place of refuge. How should we find our place of refuge? You separate yourself. He was in a mountain. He was away from everybody and everything. And then you stay until you get what you need. We don't know exactly what time, other than that it was evening, that Jesus got alone into a mountain apart to pray. Jesus separated himself on the mountain. So we don't know exactly, other than that he went there, according to verse 25. We don't know what time he got there. But what we do know is when he was seen next. He was seen in the fourth watch of the night. That's between 3 and 6 a.m. Okay? What am I saying? Jesus took time to spend hours with his Father. Are you lacking this morning? Are you spent? Are you a little bit worn out? Are you a lot worn out? Are you struggling? Spend some time with the Lord. That's what's going to refresh you. That's what's going to give you the strength you need. Hey, you know, give the kids a bag of chips and send them off somewhere. Get alone with God. Do something to get away. Ask somebody to spend some time with your children, or ask your husband or your wife. If you need that time, get away so that you can gain the spiritual refreshment. But if God interrupts you in that process, you could be on the verge of God accomplishing one of the greatest things he'll ever accomplish with your life in the middle of that worn out, frustrated, and torn down state. And you know what Satan's going to tell you? You're loose. You're useless. You failed. You're a loser. See, God's punishing you right now.